Well, it certainly is good to be with you for these few days. I appreciate the invitation to come. I appreciate Ron for many reasons, but not the least of which is he is the one making the announcements instead of me. I'd rather preach three times than make announcements once. So I'm grateful that he's doing that and I'm here. I appreciate the elders in this congregation. I appreciate all of you that I know. I've been here before. You knew what you were getting when I came, so it's your fault, no matter what may happen. But I appreciate very much the invitation to come, and I ask you, as I always do, that you will examine very, very carefully, very closely, with great scrutiny, everything that I say. And if I say something you think will mislead or is harmful or is contrary to the scriptures, I would count you a friend to let me know about that. I won't be angry with you because of that. But if you find that truth is taught, and I hope it will be, then all I ask is that you accept that just as I have too. We're all in the same boat. I'm no expert by any means on the family, but I've seen a number of things take place over the past few years that are very, very disturbing to me, both in the church and out of it. I remember a few years ago a case where a brother and a sister in Christ were having some marital difficulties. They were fussing and they were arguing. They couldn't agree on practically anything for a while, and one day he got to the point that he was so angry at her that he socked her in the eye. She came to Bible study with dark glasses, and it was a pretty sore scene for a little while, and they decided they needed some counseling. Like closing the door after the cows are all out. So they asked the elders for help, and the elders said, well, would you lead this study? And so we came to this study, and I called his name and said, do you love your wife? Which is a loaded question in view of what he had just done. And he said, yes, I think so. Funny way to show it, wasn't it? Then I turned to her and I said, do you love your husband? And the tears began to gush from her eyes. And she was out of control for a moment. She said, I don't think so. And I said, why do you say you don't think so? And here's her response. And I think this is at the root of many of the problems that are existing both among brethren and others in regard to the longevity of marriages. She said, I don't feel about him the way I used to. I said, ah, now we get to a root of the problem. A lot of people think that the thing that holds people together in marriage, the glue that keeps them together, is a feeling. Well, what happens when that feeling left? That's when you hit somebody in the eye, isn't it? He wasn't feeling that way when he hit her in the eye. He wasn't feeling that way when they decided they couldn't stay together. You'll see a number of facts about families. Society and media influence families more than a lot of us would like to admit. I'm not a big fan of TV and a person who spends too much time on a computer and things of this matter. If a marriage is not nurtured, it's going to fail like any other relationship. Have you ever had a friend who moved away? You were just as close as brothers or sisters. This friend moved away and you lost touch. And someone brings up that person's name after a while and you say, yes, we used to be very, very close, but we're not anymore. What happened? Well, you quit nurturing that relationship. And that's the same thing that happens in a marriage. You can live in the same house, but not know one another. You can live in the same house and not have any feelings toward one another as you used to. It happens all the time. Most people don't know what love is. Love is what builds a marriage. And by love, I don't mean simply feelings. There has to be what 1 Timothy 3, verse 4, calls know-how. I noticed a few years ago that wherever I was, women typically ask for classes and sermons on the subject of family. Men don't. And it took me a while to figure out the reason why. Men already know it all. We don't need any help. If we grew up watching mom getting slapped around by dad, we know exactly what to do in treating a wife, don't we? What would you think if you're ready to take off on an airplane flying across the world, and you walked in and the cockpit doors open and you see me back, me in there holding to a thingy? And you say, do you know how to fly a plane? I don't have a clue what you call these controls. I like to be flown, but I've never flown, but I've always wanted to. Would you stay on the plane or would you get off? I won't wait for an answer. And yet you have a young man and a young woman and they're about to get married and you say, what makes you think you two can work this out? And we've always wanted to. The same reason I would give for flying that plane. Something's going to crash here. And when it crashes, we wonder, what took place? Well, obviously, what took place, there was no know-how. In 1 Timothy 3, speaking of elders, but it applies to anyone who wants to take God seriously, he has to be one who, verse 4, 1 Timothy 3, 4, rules his own house well, having his children in submission with all reverence. For if a man does not know how to rule his own house, how will he take care of the church of God? If he does not know how, there has to be know-how in any proper relationship. Now let's talk about love for a moment. It's a much misunderstood word. I lay much of the blame at the feet of Hollywood and of those who have been taken in by the Hollywood model of what love is. Love regulates every relationship we have. We know that. We know in Matthew 22, Jesus makes it very plain to us, we're to love the Lord our God. This is what the whole law is built on. Love the Lord our God with all our heart and soul and mind and strength. And then the second is like it, our neighbors, ourselves. He said, you can take these two commandments, number one and number two, and pin to them every single commandment that's listed in the Old Testament. Because loving God basically is, if you love Him, you'll keep His commandments, John 14, 15. And you see the same thing in Romans 13, 8 through 10. Love is comprehensive. It's like an insurance policy on your car. If you get comprehensive, then if some meteorite falls from the sky, that's supposed to cover the car. If some alien from outer space comes and knocks your windows out, that's supposed to be covered. It's comprehensive. And this love comprehends everything the law says. So everything we're going to talk about, you can say, well, love your wife, love your husband. Well, what do we mean by that? That's the issue with some. Now, love is the foundation on which, based on these passages, we have the church, even in existence. It's the basis on which we do what we do at work. We're faithful in our relationship to our employer or our employees. The same way with our government submission. We submit to the authorities that be because we love God and we keep His commandments, and that's one of them. The same thing with our recreation. But this morning, let's look for a moment as to what this means with regard to the family. There are four greatly overlapping words that were used to describe love. Now, there's some 20, but I'm talking about biblical words. The first one of which we speak of as desire. The New Testament never uses the word erotic or the word that produces the word erotic, but in its place comes the word desire. Sometimes the word lust would be used. It's the desire for a thing, and you'll see this used in Scripture. Proverbs chapter 7, for example, at verse 18. Come, let us take our fill of love until morning. This is a woman who is a harlot who meets a young man who is devoid of any understanding. And she uses the word we would expect in this context. Come, let us take our fill of love until morning. Let us delight ourselves with love, second time it occurs, for my husband is not at home. There you have it. That's Hollywood before there was a Hollywood. And it's as immoral as it can be. But look at this. In Proverbs 4, just a few pages over, at verse 6. This is speaking of wisdom. It's personifying wisdom as someone we must love. Verse 6, do not forsake her and she will preserve you. Speaking of wisdom, love her and she will keep you. And do you know the word love there is the very same one you had in Chapter 7, verse 18. The very same word as that. It refers to an affection. The context has to tell you whether that affection is pure or impure, whether it's divine or human. Esther 2, verse 17 makes the point. The king, this is Xerxes, Ahasuerus, loved Esther more than all the other women, and she obtained grace and favor. So here's the love of a husband for his wife. There's a proper place for physical desire between a man and a woman. There's never a place for that kind of desire between a man and a man and a woman and a woman. or between a man and an animal, or between a man and a child, and that sort of thing. That's taboo from the beginning to the end of Scripture. But there is a proper place for the fulfillment of that desire between a man and a woman, both of whom are eligible, and that is in the marriage relationship, a marriage that God approves of. Now, the king loved Esther more than all the other women. He had this physical desire for her. I don't know how much farther his desire went. If it didn't go much farther, it wasn't a proper marriage, even in God's sight. Now, the second word we have is the word that typically refers to natural affection. It occurs two times in the New Testament, and both times it's given in a negative form. Romans 1:31, also in 2 Timothy 3, verse 3. I'll just read the latter of these. It speaks in the New King James of unloving. These are characteristics of people in perilous times in the last days. Unloving there is rendered heartless by the ESV in the same passage. And I found it interesting that it's rendered inhuman in the New Revised Standard Version. When you had a case in the ancient world where a soldier writes his wife and he says, now I know you're expecting this baby, I'm excited about this. If it is a boy, then take good care of it. If it is a girl, expose her. And by expose her, he means take her to the Colosseum, put her there and just leave her. And it could be some slave trader will come by, some animal may eat her. She'll just die of the elements and starvation or whatever. They had a greater need for workers than they did for homemakers. And so they exposed their children sometimes. That's a soldier writing. That's inhuman, but it happened. And it's no more inhuman, actually, than what you see happening in the United States of America with the abortion industry, multi-million-dollar industry, if not billions, that has killed millions of children for the last several years, ever since 1973. So you'll see occasions where people have no love whatever. Now, this natural affection is something you better not mess with. You take a mother. She's like a mother bear. You don't get between a mother bear and her cubs, do you? If I were to walk up to some mother's child and say, boy, he's a brat, isn't he? I'm liable to be in the hospital, aren't I? Now, she can say that about her own child, but I dare not. And you can have a situation that develops where this bond between this mother and the child never goes away. I attended a meeting, I think it was last year, and I had to sit near the back, and I was talking to these people I know in front of me. And the wife, 10 minutes before it started, she kept looking back, and then 5 minutes go by, she kept looking back. A minute before it starts, she keeps looking back. And finally it starts, she keeps looking back. Thought, what in the world? He's not even preaching yet. You're looking at the clock? But it wasn't that at all. About 5 minutes later, after it started, her grown, she's probably close to 25 to 30, her grown daughter, who had been driving there by herself at night, came in, and from that point, the mother never looked back again. Once you're a mother, you're always a mother. You never get to the point where you don't look back and say, is she all right? And then you see the word that refers to friendship, the tender affection. And we see various places where this occurs. Luke 14, verse 12. He said to him who invited him, when you give a dinner or a supper, do not ask your friends. Your friends there is this word we typically use for love of friendship. Your brothers, your relatives, or rich neighbors. But a surprise comes here when you talk about the overlap of these words. It's that word for friendship, as we typically define it, that occurs in 1 Corinthians 16:22. If anyone does not love the Lord Jesus Christ, let him be accursed or anathema. You love the Lord Jesus Christ? You would have expected a higher word there. Now, here's the point we make here. A marriage that is based only on this, only on friendship, only on affection, only on looks. What happens when the friendship disappears? Well, the love's gone, and according to Dear Abby, when the love goes, you can go. Right? That's what everybody's hearing. And when the looks go, I mean, after 30-something years, I didn't always look like this. After 30-something years, the looks go. Now, if you married someone just on the basis of looks, and the looks go south, what are you going to do? It has to be something more than this gluing people together, without which people are going to get some socks in the eye and worse things than that. Divorces. So that brings up this fourth word. And it's a word we typically speak of, and it's proper that we do so. It refers to the choice, the will, the person who says, I have determined, through thick or thin, we're going to stay together, we're going to do God's will, we're going to serve Him, whether I feel like it or whether I don't. I gave my vows, I meant those, they are for life, till death do us part. And that's just the way it is. You're stuck with me whether you ought to be or not. And that's the idea that you see so many times based on this word. In Matthew 5:44, you're to love your enemies. What a strange command. Now, is he saying you should have this desire for your enemies? Number one definition? Obviously not. Are you to have this natural affection for them, like a mother for... No, that's not what he's saying. Or to have this friendship where you can go up and just put your arm around this enemy. Well, you do that, he's liable to stab you in the side. No. But you can love your enemy in this fourth sense, which means you find him, maybe he's the guy lying there on the road who's been mercilessly beaten and left to die by the robbers, and you happen up on him. You don't look at him and say, well, I'm not close to him. He's not my friend. And so you just go your way. No, you say, he's a human being, and I love him just for that. He's probably someone who in other circumstances would spit in my face, but he needs help, and I'm going to help him. I'm going to do what's right. And if you look at Matthew 5 and Luke 6, it gives the parallel. You pray for your enemy. You do good for those who spitefully use you. You do what is in their best interest. And that's what we mean when we speak of love. You act in the object's best interest. And if you don't do that, you don't have the proper love. Love is goodness in action. Romans 5, verse 8. But God demonstrates His own love toward us in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. If God's love were dependent upon His feelings about us so that it has His warm feeling of affection, He never would have sent His Son to die for us. We were His enemies. But He can act in this best interest by this choice, not the impulse of feelings. And that's exactly what He did. Now let's talk for a moment about the relationships. The husband-wife relationship. Ephesians 5 gives to the man the supreme test of love. Ephesians 5:25, husbands, love your wives. And then Paul does something that he is notorious for. I don't mean the notorious in a negative way here. He uses a little adverb, as. And it explains the degree to which we are to love the wife. If he had just said, husbands, love your wives. On a scale of 1 to 100, you say, well, I'm about a 0.1. You could claim it. But no, verse 25, husbands, love your wives just as Christ also loved the church and gave Himself for her. How much did He love the church? He gave Himself for her. And the worst kind of giving, the most painful suffering He's willing to go through to save the church. What about us? I have to admit to you, I cannot comprehend that level of love. I don't think any of us reach that level. It's a directional command, and we continue to go in that direction the longer we live. We never reach the point where we say, now, you know what, last Tuesday, I arrived in my maturity level to the point where I love my wife as much as Christ loves the church. You'd probably take issue with that. I have a feeling someone else would too. But then He goes on to give us another illustration, another description that I think we can better understand. In verse 25, He's talked about loving her as Christ loved the church. And that goes through verse 27. As soon as He's through with that, in verse 28, so husbands ought to love their own wives as, and you expect Him to say, as Christ loved the church. Paul repeats himself some, and so he frames it, or he brackets this, and he has meat in the middle. But no, that's not what he does. So husbands ought to love their wives as their own bodies. There's another as. He's still describing how much. But he's saying, as you would treat yourself. It's Matthew 7:12. You treat another as you'd want to be treated. In this case, you treat your wife that way. Now, I can understand that. One fellow said, This hit me when I found it a lot easier for me to buy a couple of rifles to go hunting with than it was for me to give my wife money to buy a new washing machine. He could see it. And that's exactly what he's telling us. And that may involve some money. So that's the self-test. Am I loving my wife to the same degree that I would love myself? What does that involve? First of all, I must be pleasant. Colossians 3, verse 19. Husbands, love your wives and do not be bitter toward them. Now, that means don't be bitter, harsh, severe, irritated. Man, you ever get irritated with your woman? Ephesians 4:31, a synonymous expression, a former use of it. He says in verse 31, let all bitterness and then wrath, anger, clamor, evil speaking be put away from you with all malice. And so as we associate with one another in the church, that's what we are to avoid. But you mean we're to treat brothers like that, but not our wife? We're to be very careful about brothers and sisters in Christ, but we can be bitter and full of wrath and anger and irritable and agitated toward a wife, but we can't toward one another. That wouldn't make sense because the wife is one of those, isn't she? In Genesis 16, there's a famous account where Abraham and Sarah, who have been unable to have children, decide they need to help God out a little. So Abraham hears Sarah say, here's Hagar, my handmaid, go into her. God has said, you're going to have a son. He didn't exactly say that I'll be the one to bear the son, but I'm old and I'm barren. I can't do it. Take Hagar, produce a child by her. He does. And no sooner does that child get up and start sassing a little, and Hagar starts sassing a little, Sarah blames Abraham. How could you bring this upon me? Now, you know what Abraham does? I have great respect for this man, as we should. He doesn't answer back. He doesn't say, oh yeah, well, I remember this was your idea to start with. He doesn't say a word about that. He doesn't get historical. The thing that destroys a lot of marriages is history. People bring up the past history. You can live on the present problem, but if you add the past problems to the present and anticipate all the future problems that are coming and continue to accumulate those, you're never going to make it. You have too big a burden for any person to bear. Let each day be sufficient for its own problems, Jesus said. And that's true not only of worry, but of a marital relationship. Now, I don't know if Colossians 3:19 was written because men are naturally irritable or if women naturally provoke irritation. But it doesn't matter because it's a negative. He says, don't do it. Oh, but she, it doesn't matter. He said, don't do it. And she, oh, but he can't do it. So that's the issue here. Number two, he's to provide. 1 Timothy 5:8, if you provide not for your own, you've denied the faith and are worse than an infidel. And then that means to care for someone. And then third, to prize someone. He's to prize her. 1 Peter 3 uses the word honor. Sometimes men say, well, I would honor my wife, I would do these things for her, but I'm afraid she'll start taking advantage of me. She'll grow to expect that kind of thing, you know? And she'll take advantage of me and demand more and more and want me to do more and more. Actually, it works the other way. It produces in her a reciprocation that makes her want to do better toward you. In 1 Peter 3:7, likewise, you husbands, dwell with them with understanding. And while he doesn't go so far as to say you must understand your wife, he does say you dwell with them in an understanding manner. You're sensitive to God's will and what he wants you to do in this relationship. That's what that means. Dwell with them with understanding, giving honor to the wife as to the weaker vessel, and as being heirs together of the grace of life. Now that giving honor is an interesting word here. Understanding with honor and attention. In verse 8, the King James, New King James, gives us the word courteous. It's based on a manuscript difference that some of your versions are going to have a different word here in verse 8. But finally, all of you be of one mind, having compassion with one another. Love as brothers, be tenderhearted, be courteous. And if you break this word down, you look at the word court here. He's already in chapter 2, verse 17, told the brethren, honor all people. There's your word honor. Love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king. The king is in his court. You honor him. You know how people go into court and they'll bow before the king and they'll bow before the queen. And there are no unsavory remarks made between the king and the queen or by anyone toward them. You show the respect as you would someone in court. And so we have chosen in our society, I don't know who started it, to refer to the relationship between a young man and a young woman as courtship. Courtship. And the problem with many marriages is, instead of courting a wife, giving honor that is befitting a royal court, treating her like a queen, it changes once he snags her. During the courtship, yes, treat her like a queen. After the courtship, treat her like an old hag. Something's wrong with this picture, and that's not what Peter says to do. You know, I've seen Jewish weddings. And one thing that's always true of every Jewish wedding I know about, and it was true in ancient times as well, is the man is pictured. He's addressed as the king. The wife as the queen. That's courtship. And that sets it off on that footing. Whatever you were before, whatever you were during this courtship period, now you really enter into the fullness of that relationship and courting her as you should. Now, let's talk for a moment about the wife toward the husband. I'm very glad we can make this progress. In Titus 2, verse 4, she is to love. And this is a rather strange thing when you think about it. The older women, verse 3, are to be trainers of the younger women. They can address issues and help younger women in ways that no man can. Verse 4, that they admonish the young women. They put them in mind to love their husbands and to love their children. And you wonder, why in the world would he have to say this? Well, more about that in a moment. This love is... what he uses here, this word and the expression of it, is it was common on epitaphs in the ancient world. In 1 Timothy 2, verse 15, her longing is that she will conduct herself in a way that is in the best interest of her family. That's the chief goal she has in life. Nevertheless, she will be saved in childbearing if they continue in faith, love, and holiness with self-control. In 2 Timothy 3, verse 6, her liability. There's a danger. There are some who have turned away from the power of godliness in 2 Timothy 3:5. Of this sort are those who creep into households and make captives of gullible women, little women, loaded down with sins, led away by various lusts, always learning and never able to come to the knowledge of the truth. So there was a great deal of fear that this woman would be disturbed, that would disturb families. Apparently false teachers are going around and disturbing families. I think they're still doing it. I think what you read in the paper from Dear Abby, what you read by famous counselors, people who tell you, well, the love's gone, it's in your best interest and best interest of the children to go your separate ways. I think they're still disturbing children. Nothing's changed here. She is to show her husband respect. Ephesians 5:33 ends with these words. Nevertheless, let each one of you in particular so love his own wife as himself. And let the wife see that she respects her husband. She's not going to go and sit at a party with a group of ladies, all of which may be good in itself. Maybe they're writing cards for the sick and so on. And turn that into an occasion to start slandering their husbands. You know what my genius did last night? Oh, well, let me tell you about mine. And then it becomes anything but respect. That's not what he says to do. Romance should not leave the marriage. In 1 Corinthians 7, verse 5, the husband's to render to the wife due benevolence, the wife to the husband. If there's an exception in this, they part for a little while for the purpose of spiritual things, that they may pray, for example, and then they come together again, lest Satan tempt you for your lack of self-control. So they maintain this in the marriage relationship. And then there's also the restraint on her part not to be a natural-born ruler over the husband. In Titus 2, verse 5, she is to be discreet, chaste, homemakers, good, obedient to their own husbands, that the word of God may not be blasphemed. That word here is submit, to subject herself to him, to subordinate, to obey. People look at that as an ugly word today, and they overlook the fact that we all submit to the government. We pay our taxes. We do what the policeman says. If he says pull over, all he has to do is turn a light on, and we immediately obey. We submit. We don't do that because he's a better person than we are. or because he's smarter than we are, or because he's worth more than we are. Because that's what God said. God's own Son submitted to the Father. There's an equality. He purposely takes upon himself the limitations of flesh, purposely submitting himself to his Father, humbling himself, and submits even to death on the cross. He didn't take on the form of a man. He took on the form of a servant, a lowly kind of man, who being in the form of God, he takes on also this form of a servant. That's what Christ did. Don't have a problem with this. Let me tell you this. Any man who loves his wife the way Christ loved the church, that's his goal. He's working toward that and improving all along. And he loves her as himself. Typically, a woman's not going to mind being in subjection to that kind of man. Now, in Proverbs, I feel such pity for Solomon. He has 700 wives, 300 concubines, and three times in this book he writes words similar to these. Proverbs 19:13, a foolish son is the ruin of his mother, and the contentions of a wife are continual dripping. He talks about getting up on a housetop, going out into the woods to get some peace. He knew what this was, and it was not a very pretty picture. Let's talk then for the balance of our time on the parents and the children. Titus 2:4, we said we'd come back to this, that they admonish the young women to love their husbands. Okay, you can possibly understand why he would say that. But then to love their children. Isn't that kind of like saying to someone, love your ice cream? They're going to love their children regardless, aren't they? Why would he say, love your children? Isn't that just something that comes natural? Like that mother bear we talked about? Nobody trains the mother bear to love her children. Polar bears are different. He'll eat his children if you don't watch, but not the mother. So why do you have to tell a mother to love her children? I think there are things that go on, and I don't know if this is the correct answer or not, but I see in the practical way, things do go on, where a woman becomes drained of all energy after 6 or 7 years of diapers every day. That's not too invigorating, is it? Discipline of the children while the husband's away, the disrespect that she may get, that could be part of this. She may be disturbed over a number of issues that we didn't have to have. Now, issues come and go. My grandmother had 8 children, lost 4. That was fairly typical for her era. One of them fell into a vat of lard as it was being cooked, and he healed outside but didn't heal inside and died. That'd be my uncle. Never saw him. It was very common for them to die of what they call consumption, what we call TB today. And they didn't have antibiotics or other things to help with those. And so it was very typical for people to lose children. Today, we have other issues. I don't think they're quite that serious. It could be that way again with superbugs. But you have the sickness of a child. You can have a mother lying out on the couch and the little child in the bedroom and she's listening. She's been awake for 2 nights and is trying to get any nap she can while the sick child naps. And if he makes any kind of noise, any stir at all, she's on her feet and in that room, isn't she? He's absolutely exhausted. We talk about shots today. There's great controversy. Do I get the shots? How many? Do I use the European method, the American method? Things that you didn't have to worry about years ago. You can't not get the shots because they might get all kinds of disease. But if you do get them, they're saying, well, this is linked to this and that. And I don't know about this. And a lot of women don't know about it. And they're having to do this with their children. School, what's going on in schools today are things we never heard of when I was going to school. And so there are all kinds of issues that give them problems. When you add this to the short nights, you talk about short nights and short fuses, don't you? Don't those go together typically? And so you might have to remind this woman, you know, these are your children. Love those children. And then you add to that being distracted by other things. A lot of women are more concerned about money these days than they are about children or family. A lot are far more concerned about social networking than they are about training their children. I know a woman who has 4 children, 2 older and 2 younger. She has the 2 older take care of the 2 younger every day while she spends all day on the computer. That's not what this is saying she used to be. She needs someone to tell her, love your children. So I can see how these things may occur. I don't know if that's what was particular in his mind or not, but what's included in this relationship of the parents and the children? First of all, instill within your child esteem for parental authority. Proverbs 1:8. It starts out right at the very beginning where Solomon is warning children and the parents by extension to Show that proper respect for the mother and the father. My son, hear the instruction of your father. That means the father better be giving some instruction. And do not forsake the law of your mother. Here's father and mother, both jointly doing the raising of the child. Ephesians 6, 1 through 3. One of the most well-known passages on this subject. This is talking, first of all, to the fathers. Children, obey your parents. Now, that's plural. It includes the mother as well. And the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise. So, verse 1, they're to obey mother and father. That's a take on Proverbs 1:8 and so many other passages. Proverbs is practically a manual explaining these things. You honor them that it may be well with you and you may live long on the earth. I found a practical illustration of this in Luke 23. What happens in many households is what was happening with Pontius Pilate as Jesus was being tried. You'll see in Luke 23 that Pilate knows the truth about this man. He has said some 8 times in Luke, he's innocent. He's not guilty. And yet, having said that, they shouted out in verse 21, crucify him, crucify him. They start shouting. That's a little intimidating. That kind of shouts him down. So he tries again in verse 22, and this time he offers a compromise. He says to them the third time, why, what evil has he done? I have found no reason for death in him. I'll therefore chastise him and let him go. Now, wait a minute. If he's innocent, why are you going to chastise him? The compromise just feeds their desire for the blood. And so, that's the way it works. If they had held their breath, he would have given up his throne. He's like a typical parent who is in a shouting match with his children instead of laying down the law and having raised them to understand the voice control that will make it stick. I preached the funeral of a lady a year or so ago. She had trained her daughters voice control. You know what that means? It means that when she says something, she doesn't have to raise her voice to the decibel level of a jet plane to get their attention. You know, that's typically what happens. A child's over here playing, you say, Junior, you have 5 minutes, you're going to go to bed. 5 minutes are up, he's still playing. She says, okay, Junior, go to bed. He doesn't move. She shouts louder. She starts to shout, I should say, go to bed. He doesn't listen. Finally, she gives it all she has. She gets down close to his ear and she shouts as loud as she can shout, go to bed. And finally he says, oh, now she means it. And he gets up and he goes. He has no respect for her because she has no respect for the authority God gave her. This lady taught her children voice control or snap control. If they're in a room somewhere and her children are doing something they shouldn't, she can just merely look at them and go like this. And they automatically stop and freeze and look at her and say, what do you want us to do? What am I doing wrong? And a few years ago, they were at a family reunion. These girls are grown and married, and she snapped her finger for some other reason, and both daughters just stopped and froze and looked at her. It does work. And everybody is a whole lot happier. I don't know if the children are, but the parents certainly are. And that's the way it ought to be. The children are not allowed to make you miserable. It's your job to make them miserable when they need it. And do it with a smile on your face, and do it with total voice control. No shouting aloud. You don't need it. There's an exercise of discipline. Now, Solomon speaks of this quite a lot. It's taboo today even to read these passages, but they're still true, and we still need to heed them. He who spares his rod hates his son, but he who loves him disciplines him promptly. There are occasions where a junior will go up to dad and ask for permission to do something. He'll say, no. He says, well, it's still not over. You know, you can appeal to a higher court. So he goes to mom. And she, not knowing that he spoke to dad and sees nothing wrong with it, says, okay, go. Or maybe he wears her down with his constant dripping. It's children drip too, you know. It's not just women that were married to Solomon. She wears him down after 5 minutes, and he says, okay, you can go. Then the dad finds out that now you've got this divided and conquered situation. He did what Caesar did. He divided and he conquered. When you do that, you've lost the war with your child. There will be one time and one time only when a child does this, when he asks one and is told no and then goes to the other. After that, he'll know, I'll never do that again. It's too much to pay. But if he allows it and it's going on He's allowed to go on this way, and then he'll keep using it, and he will rule the house, just like many young people rule the schools these days. Hebrews 12 speaks in verse 5 about the desire to give the proper discipline. This is to Christians, but he's quoting our book, Proverbs, in Proverbs 3. My son, do not despise the chastening of the Lord, nor be discouraged when you're rebuked by him. For whom the Lord loves, he chastens and scourges every son whom he receives. And then the emphasis has to be on the soul. You fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the training, the admonition of the Lord. This requires respecting the rights of others. You're not going to be David's son Absalom, who burns Joab's field to get his attention. Children who have no respect for the authority and the rights of others, they may come to your home once, but you're not going to have them back, are you? They're swinging by the chandeliers. You'll say, well, once is enough. I'm satisfied. They won't be back here. Choose for them a righteous companion. And you do that by training them from their earliest days. You marry a certain kind of person. Now, what kind of person do you want this child to marry? You want him to marry someone who will help him go to heaven when he dies, and someone whom he can help go to heaven when she dies. And the same for her toward him. Genesis 24 shows this with reference to Abraham. I've seen too many cases where a young man says, I think I can change him. I'm going to marry him. He's not a Christian, but I think I can change him. And so the marriage takes place. This man she marries never darkens the door of the church building. The young lady continues to come for a while, then she starts to fade on Wednesday nights, then you don't see her on Sunday nights, then you don't see her very often on Sunday mornings. After all, well, he's going to do this with friends, and I didn't want to be ugly and leave him out. He would be the only one without a wife there, and that sort of thing. And they quit. You couldn't see this coming? You have this person, they used to talk about it this way, she's standing up in a chair. And you have this fellow who comes up and he grabs her hand and he pulls. Now, who's going to win this war? He's pulling her down to his level. How easy is it going to be for him to pull her down as opposed to her pulling him up? Can it happen? Yes. But don't take that risk. If he's not going to listen to God before you marry, what makes you think he's going to after you marry when he's no longer trying to impress you and the courtship is stopped? And then remember God. Ecclesiastes 12 verse 1, the center stage sees a light come on, and walking up to the podium is this hoary-headed philosopher who announces to that and to all future generations of young people, remember now your Creator in the days of your youth. And he goes on to describe how these evil days are going to come when you have no pleasure in them. Remember him now in the days of your youth. That means you put God first, and then all these other things will be added to you. It means you put your time first for God, redeeming the time because the days are evil. It means you don't forsake the assemblies. We know a young man back home who was a very good athlete. His parents, when he was in grammar school, elementary school, they call it these days, he was told by his parents, if you want to play football, it's fine, but you're never going to miss attending. You'll be there Sunday morning, you'll be there Sunday night, you'll be there Wednesday night. If we have a meeting, you'll be there every night. Meeting, he said, okay, that's a deal. But we have to make sure this coach understands this from the very first day. He said, that's fine. So the parents would go and they'd talk to the coach. He said, fine, he's a good enough player, they're willing to work with him. When he got into high school, they said, now, it's up to you. You can't just merely have our faith. You go to the coach and you tell him what you're going to do. And he did. And they worked with him. And I told the parents not long ago that I've used his illustration before as a very good example of what a young person ought to be. You can put God first, regardless of sports, regardless of jobs and all these other things. And the father recently said to him, well, let me tell you the rest of the story. He said, this son of his graduated from high school just last year, I think. And he said, after the season was over, the coach met with his parents and some other coaches standing there, and he said, you know, I've really respected your son for the stand he took. And he said, when you think about it, what he's doing is a lot more important than football anyway. And I don't think that could have happened if they had caved in early and never stood for what they knew God would want them to do. Now, I'll tell you what you can do. You can go to a hollow log and live in that and call it home. But most of us want a little more than that, don't we? You may go to a log cabin, have no running water, no electricity. You say, well, maybe 2 weeks, but no, I prefer something else. And most of us prefer a regular home with all the amenities and the comforts, don't we? I tell you what you can do in your family. You can have the equivalent of a hollow log. You know what that is? When the fights come, just go. Just leave. Cut and run. But if you think that's going to make you happy, you better think again. Because all the problems you took into that marriage, you're taking into whatever other marriage you're going to get in. Not only are you now wrong with God, you're going to be wrong with every other person you're with. You're the problem. And the problem hasn't gone. That's living in a hollow log. I'll tell you what else you can do. You can say, well, I would never divorce my wife for some frivolous reason, but we're going to fight it out to the bitter end. Well, maybe you will, but that's still not the ideal. That's living in a place without electricity and running water. Don't you want something better? You can choose for your marriage relationship something that is as close as you can get to heaven on earth. But it's going to take getting into this book, letting God speak to your heart, and applying that in your life. Thank you very much for your excellent attention this morning.